There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1088, March 30th, 2025. Steven.
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads provide you, the F1Weekly.com web surfer, with ads that interest you. From tickets to the Canadian Grand Prix to ringtones for your cell phone, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, Yuki gets the call to partner Max. Liam gets demoted back to V-Carb. Is LCH Ferrari Dream turning into the Prost Nightmare? And can Aston Martin really be competitive in 2026 to make it all worthwhile for Fernando? And this week's interview, more classic, Nasser Hamid. And we've got a good one. A big one, and that's with Nigel Mansell. So you'll enjoy that tremendously, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. The swap to V-Carb. Yuki gets the promo. And I think it's sort of a nice gesture for Yuki. At a Honda track in Japan, in front of his people, which adds a little more pressure for him to be up there with Max in the points, in qualifying, in FP1, FP2. Yuki has got to perform, and I think if anybody can do it, it's Yuki. He has become surely much more mature than what he was a few years ago, telling everybody to shut up. And Nasser never liked that kind of back talk, and I think he's grown into a very quick driver, needs to be maybe a little more consistent, but surely he will be competitive. If not, we know what will happen. But nevertheless, he will, believe it or not, finish the entire season with Red Bull, while Liam obviously has to out-qualify Hajar, who's been very quick and impressive once he got his crap together after Australia. So I see a fascinating Japanese Grand Prix where we've got Red Bull, who's really got a crappy car, and I feel sorry for Max, but on the other hand, he seems a lot more relaxed, and let's face it, 5 world championships in a row is not an easy task. You have to have a lot of planets aligned and a large dose of good karma. And now we have to switch over to LCH. After the high of winning the sprint race and then the mega low of total disqualification by both Ferraris, it was yin and yang. I mean, it was so, no pun intended, by the way, but it was just unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. I don't know what Toto thinks, but it was quite devastating to Lewis. And they really, really need to bounce back. Lewis, you know, he's talking 8th world championship. His fans are talking 8th world championship. And I see nothing like that in his future, apparently, in my F1 Weekly crystal ball. But, boy, I wish Nasser was here to just bring a certain insight to this because I find it unbelievable. And let's not forget, folks, I know he always says that he's not old, he'll never be old, but he's still 40 years old. And the body does decay, whether you like it or not, even if you're on the best diet in the world. So folks, really, this is a big LCH moment. Suzuka is a perfect track to display this unbelievable comeback in the third race of the season. So this is going to be a good one. And it's all going to start in qualifying, where we really need to see the big guns up front. And of course, we've got George, who's so pumped up. Antonelli, so much talent at Mercedes. They do have a quick car. And of course, McLaren, the dominant team this year. And I think their suspension has a lot to do with their tire management. But will we see sparks fly between Piastri and Norris? Because I think Piastri, it's the amount of hunger for the win and the championship that's going to come out at McLaren. And will Norris have the testicular fortitude that everybody questions day in and day out? Because Piastri, calm, cool, and very boring, can take it home. And an Aussie championship would be phenomenal for Formula One. So we've got a big one, ladies and gentlemen. I can't wait. You can't wait. So that will be fun to watch next weekend. So here we go. This is a classic Nasser Hamid interview. It was at the Indy Lights practice at Laguna Seca, early 2008. Wonderful weather. You've got a Nigel Mansell, or as they say in France, Nigel Mansell, in a good mood, ready to chat, just needs a couple of cups of tea, and he is ready to go. So enjoy, and once again, Nass, I miss you a whole lot.
And now that Nass has stepped out of the white Camry, Nass, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Thank you, sir. Greetings and racing regards to all from Manteca in California to Melbourne in Australia.
We have a special interview, what we call the Machismo interview, and of course, none other than former world champion Nigel Mansell. Nass, this man probably needs no introduction, but let's introduce him anyway.
Yeah, thank you. What happened here, about a week ago, I found out that the Atlantics were testing here, and I knew that the Mansell boys are in Atlantics. So I said, you know, if the kids are here, Papito might be here too. So I contacted Miss Elizabeth Cannon, who is the PR lady for Walker Racing, and she confirmed that he plans to be there. So, and she couldn't make it, so I was there, of course. I took a day off on Monday. And so this conversation took place on March 10th, 2008, that's for the record, at Laguna Seca. And it was very nice. Good thing was there were not many people, so he gave me a lot of time. So we're going to put this thing in two parts. First part is today, and then, you know, following week will be the second part. And I was able to talk to him, basically. And, you know, a lot of things were happening with Mansell in his career. I mean, there was drama and, you know, he's leading a race. He's leading the world championship. Tire blows up. He's waving to the crowd. And, you know, his car stops on the final lap. The duels he had with Ayrton Senna. I was able to get in all of those questions. And it was very nice and kind of him to explain a lot of things, what the facts were, because, you know, a lot of time you read stuff, it may not be exactly what happened there. So I would like to thank him very much for taking the time and sitting down with me. And an interesting thing happened. He started listening in the middle of our conversation, and as I said, what's going on here? He says, I got to get a cup of tea here. So a brief, look back on his career. He was British Formula Ford 1600 champion, 1977. He was second in the Formula 3 championship in 1979, and of course Formula 1 world champion 1992, after finishing second three times, 1986, 1987, and in 1991, and he was car champion in his rookie year, 1993. And he is very proud of the fact that he's the only driver in motor racing history to hold two top-tier titles at the same time across the pond, which is very, very impressive. In Grand Prix wins, he is the most successful British driver of all time with 31 victories, which puts him in fourth on the all-time list. His first win came in 1985 at Brands Hatch, a European Grand Prix driving for Honda-powered Williams, and his final win was in Australia in 1994 for the same team, but this time powered by?
Oh, no.
Thank you. And in 1986 and 1992, he received the BBC Sports Personality of the Year award. And I have to say this, I cannot think of any racing driver who became world champion where he went through so much of hurdles and setbacks. I mean, this is an incredible story.
And lots of controversy. He was, people loved to hate Nigel Mansell. He was outspoken. And he was brash and demanding at teams, you know.
Yeah.
He thought he was a prima donna, you know, the Jesus. So he's a very interesting character.
Yeah, you know, he talks about, I mean, he made a very interesting comment that some drivers, not all racing drivers are racing drivers. Some are more like drivers. And it's interesting the names he takes, some very big names, he considers them as drivers. And also, you know, his rivalry with Nelson Piquet and what Mario Andretti was not very complimentary towards him recently. So I was able to bring up all those issues, and it was very nice that he answered all those things instead of telling me, okay, it's over now, like you are doing right now.
So keep up the good work. And now, an interview with Nigel Mansell.
Okay, I'm at Laguna Seca with 1992 world champion Mr. Excitement Nigel Mansell. Nigel, welcome back to California, and how are you today, sir?
Very, very good. It's we've had three climates here. We've had beautiful sunshine, it was too hot this morning, and then just perfect conditions lunchtime, and then very cold this afternoon.
But it never rains in California.
No, it snows though.
Very true. Okay, first I want to ask a little bit about your kids. Leo and Greg are now competing in the U.S. Why the shift from the European scene to the U.S.?
I think for a change in the way racing is done. It's a great learning curve coming over to new circuits, going around circuits, for instance, anti-clockwise as opposed to clockwise all the time. And the Atlantic series is a very good, very strong series, has more horsepower than Formula 3, has the tunnel under the car, so it has a lot more ground effect. They pull over 4G, and it's a stepping stone to something bigger, hopefully, in the future.
Now, recently, Mothership Champ Car filed bankruptcy. Is that a concern for you? Do you have a plan B?
I think short-term, it's a difficult transition. But mid-term, long-term, I think it's the best thing for open-wheel racing in America. And if you had a one, you'd like to pull them together a lot sooner than now. But I think it's a positive thing for the future. And you know, I think there'll just be a settling down period, and then things will be, as I said, better.
Both your kids have competed in Formula BMW and Formula 3 in UK. What are the expectations in Atlantics this year?
I think we come with an expectation of a hard year, learning all the circuits, learning a new car, a new team, a new formula. But we hope that there'll be some race meetings. We'll be able to demonstrate that, you know, both the boys are competent drivers and quite quick. Greg, as you know, has had podiums in England, in Europe with Formula 3. Leo was going very well this afternoon until there was a slight problem coming out of the last turn. But we're optimistic that we can hopefully have a solid year.
Okay. How involved are you in guiding and managing their career?
I'd say very much so at the moment, although they're totally their own people. They make their own decisions. They're directors of Mansell Motorsport. You know, we work as a team, just like Walker Racing is a team. Mansell Motorsport is a unique little team.
Now, I noticed both your sons race in the same series, same team. Is that important for you, that they race in the same team?
At the moment, I think it's very healthy and very good. I think as they progress, I think obviously it probably won't be possible for them to be in the same team, but I don't see that a problem either. So whatever and wherever it takes them, I think will be fine with me as long as they're happy and comfortable and competing and doing what they want to do.
Now, Britain has produced more world champions than any other nation. How old were you when you developed an interest, and was there any racing interest in your family?
No, there wasn't, and my racing interest started when I was 7 or 8 years of age. And this is what's incredible with my two boys. They only started racing 2.5, 3 years ago. So they're very green under the gills, and they have a lot to learn. But, you know, their potential is quite enormous. And what they're doing with the experience they have is a great credit to them.
Are you trying to tell me they did not pay attention to Dad's career?
No, we didn't pay attention to them wanting to go racing. We were hoping they were going to be golfers. They're both basically scratch golfers, and we were hoping they were going to go the professional golf route. So, but we lost that one.
And can you tell us about your karting career, and how important is karting to a career in motor racing?
I think karting is very important, and as you know, we have Mansell Raceway in England, which is a kart track at Dunkerswell in the southwest of England. And we still race, all three of us now, in karting. Even though they're doing this, we go and have some fun in the national events. But it's the basically it's the breeding ground of future, I think, world champions. And I think when you look at how many world champions started their career in karting, it's a very, very important grassroots sport.
Now, you were the most tenacious fighter in Formula One. How tenacious were you in fighting the cancel Mansell scheme they had going?
Yeah, we're going to court now in England with noise abatement. It seems to be the way of the world at the moment. Everybody complains about the noise, and we're going to the high courts now to fight it, hopefully, and we will win, because the racetrack is on the side of an airport. The one runway is only 40 yards away from our pits. So, you know, it's a crazy situation, but unfortunately, you know, we've got to go through the process now, and hopefully we'll come out where we can still go racing.
Great. You were 1977 Formula 4 champion in UK, and I hope I have the numbers correct. 32 wins in 42 Formula 4 starts. But what is talked about more is your accident and walking out of the hospital. Can you give us a first-hand account of this, please? And I've read this so many times, and this is a very inspiring story, I must say.
Yeah, it's a crazy situation. I think you're alluding to the accident I had when I broke my neck. And it was a very serious accident. I damaged the third, fourth and fifth vertebra in my neck. And for a time, I couldn't feel my arms or my legs. And I was very upset. Some of the feeling came back, and I discharged myself after a week. I traveled to another hospital and saw a very good specialist. And he said, did I ever want to walk again? And if I did I want to live? Because he took x-rays and then asked me if he could take extra x-rays, because he's never photographed a living person with the injury that I had. Normally they would be dead. And it was a very worrying time, but a time whereby, you know, when you're young, you heal quickly. I had tremendous determination, and fortunately, a number of weeks, a couple of months later, I was out racing again in a collar which I used for my whole career.
Incredible. You know, every time I read that, it's just like, wow, so inspiring. You and your wife, Roseanne, sold your house to go Formula 3. How important was the support from your wife in the success of your career?
Well, first of all, it was the dumbest thing I've ever done, to sell a house to go racing, because within 4 weeks, the money was spent and we got fired from the team, so that was a waste of time. But my wife has been the best thing I've ever done in my life. With her support and her friendship and encouragement, we've obviously gone through many challenges, and here we are now revisiting those challenges with my sons, and it's quite a deja vu, really. She's been totally instrumental in my career and my success, and basically giving me the strength sometimes to continue where maybe I would have thought twice.
Now, was she more nervous seeing her husband race or with the kids?
I think she does very well with watching her sons, better than watching me, although if she had a choice, she'd prefer to not watch at all. But she's a wonderful lady.
You know, before we talk about your time in Formula One, looking back at your own experience, all the ups and downs, what advice will you give to young drivers who have aspirations to get into Formula One?
Well, two things. You know, to be a great race car driver, you've got to have a lobotomy. because if you had a brain, you'd do something else. It's very tough to be a race car driver. I think tougher now because the finances required to go motor racing properly is enormous. The technology has moved forward, which, you know, in some areas it makes it easier if you have the money and the technology to help you do the job. But the best advice I can give is that follow your heart. And if your heart, with whatever sport you really want to do, if you live, breathe, eat and sleep it, and you're committed enough, then, you know, and you have the talent, then you'll win through eventually. But you got to remember, in motorsport, I think it's one of the toughest sports in the world, with 98% lows and 2% highs. And, you know, it's just it's a tough campaign.
Colin Chapman, an amazing force in Formula One, gave you a testing opportunity with his team in 1980. And I hear you did the test after taking painkilling injection. Can you fill us on this, please?
Yeah, I mean, timing is everything. And I had a very serious accident at Alton Park on September the 19th, I think it was, 1979. And I somersaulted at 165 miles an hour and landed upside down on my back. And it broke my back, my lower lumbar spine. And then, would you believe, a week later,
folks, that was Nigel Mansell, not me.
A week later, I got a cup of tea coming. A week later, I had a phone call from Colin Chapman, and they said, oh, you know, we have an opportunity if you'd like to make up the sixth test driver. Thank you. The sixth test driver down at Paul Ricard. Can you be there next week? And I said, yeah, I can. He said, oh, I understood you had a bit of an accident. You're right. And I said, oh, I'm fine. And I was lying on a board in my bed with a broken back. So I called my specialist up and I said, look, I know what you're going to say, but I said, I got a chance to drive a Formula One car in a week's time. I said, you got to help me. I said, whatever you got to do, I'll do it, but I got to have painkillers, I got to have a steel corset. And he fitted me with a steel corset and gave me the most strongest painkillers so I could actually go down and drive a Formula One car.
Wow. Your Grand Prix debut was in a very beautiful place, Österreichring, but was again a painful experience. When did the fuel start leaking into the cockpit?
It was before the start of the race, and I was sitting on the grid and I was getting a sensation of burning in the car, and I couldn't understand why. I felt my buttocks being burned, and then they smelt in the car because I said I'm being burnt, and fuel was leaking out the tank, and so I was sitting in a puddle of fuel. So what they did, they poured 2 gallons of water in the cockpit to dilute it all, and of course that was great until it all drained off. And then after the start of the race, within about 5 to 10 laps in the race, the burning came back and I was being chemically burnt by the fuel because obviously it was still leaking. I did, I think, 42 laps before the engine blew up, and I had third degree burns. I had to go to the hospital to have them de-roofed, and it's very painful.
What a way to make your Grand Prix start, huh? Okay, how important was Colin Chapman in your career?
Totally. Without Colin, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have been a world champion, and I wouldn't have been able to consolidate my position in Formula One. Colin was a most charismatic, the charisma of the man. He was an entrepreneur. He was a mega designer. He was just awesome. He was one of a few. There's only a few of them. Enzo Ferrari, Colin Chapman. They are just icons in the industry, and very few people come close to their reputation.
As I was telling you earlier, I was at Monza in 1982, September, and I saw him in his motorhome, just profile of the man. And I said, man, that's, you know, there's only two people in motor racing who've done that nobody can ever do, Enzo Ferrari and Colin Chapman. What about your relationship with Peter Warr, the team manager there?
Yeah, I think it was very, very difficult for him to follow in the footsteps of Colin Chapman. He tried to do it the way Colin would do it, and I think that was a mistake. He should have done it his way, and then people would have respected that a little bit more. But he tried to dress like Colin, tried to impersonate Colin, and that was a wrong thing to do. And my relationship with him, as with a number of other people, were very delicate at that time.
Well, him throwing the cap, I have never seen that. It would never be the same.
Well, that, you just alluded to something there. It was something that only Colin could do and would do, and but you know, people do crazy things.
Yeah. Dallas, 1984. If I'm not mistaken, this was your first pole position in Formula One. What happened there? You pushing your car, collapsing. How do you remember that day? And was that your least favorite Grand Prix venue?
No, Dallas, I think, was fantastic. It's just that it was so hot and the track was breaking up. My car broke down coming across the line, and we worked so hard, and we were in the lead for a long time, and then second, and I just wanted to finish the race and get some points. If you got points, you got paid more money, so I got out of the car and pushed it over. I think I finished fifth in the end by pushing the car over the line, and then the lights went out. I don't remember anything else because, obviously, my temperature got up to about 105, and I passed out, and all I remember is waking up on a bed of ice and in the nude, and I was thinking, what the hell is going on here? I've been kidnapped by some vampires or something. So, and I remember waking up the most almighty headache. It was an amazing experience, one not to be repeated.
Yeah. Okay, how special was winning your first Formula One race on your home soil, Brands Hatch?
A very, very special moment in 1985, and you know, it's very satisfying, and to have the first win in your home country, and then another four wins. I won five Grand Prix in England, and that was fantastic.
Spain, 1986, Tio Pepe, you and Senna cockpit to cockpit to the finish line. Your thoughts on that great finish?
It was a great finish, and I thought I'd won the race, but unbeknown to me, they moved the actual finish line closer down the track, and I don't know why they did that, but they moved the finish line from where it had been all weekend, and I'm not sure they could do that, although the FIA obviously think they can do anything. But so when we passed the finish line that we qualified the day before, I was in front, but then moving the finish line forward, Ayrton was just a few inches in front, so a very close race.
Now, like I said to you earlier, you know, every time I'm talking to my racing friends and your name comes up, I always say this thing, only man, only driver who gave Senna a run for the money. You guys had such monumental battles, you know, Spain and Monaco. Did you get to know him a little bit off the track?
Yeah, no, Ayrton and I, in the later years, we had utmost respect for one another because he knew I was the only person he couldn't intimidate. And he knew I was as crazy as he was. And so you had to get a healthy respect. Otherwise, you can't race that close and not have an accident all the time. So we got on very well at the end, and it was a sad, sad day for motorsport worldwide, and especially for me, because most of my race wins, Ayrton was second, and a lot of his race wins, I was second to him. So we took a lot of race wins off one another, and there was a big void when Ayrton died, and it was a big shock to the racing world.
1986 season finale in Australia. The world was watching when you had a tire failure. A question, was there any communication with the team prior to that to come in and get fresh rubber?
Well, no, it was quite the opposite. The team said, stay out, the tires are fine. I actually radioed to say I was coming in for fresh tires, and they said no. They just checked Nelson's tires, and they were fine. But, no, sadly, everybody saw what happened. The tire exploded, and and with that, the 1986 World Championship went too.
Does that remain the biggest disappointment of your racing career?
No, not really. I mean, it was the most spectacular disappointment that everybody shared with me. But, you know, I was three times runner-up in the World Championship, so, if you like, I had three disappointments, but that was the big one in 86 to get over, losing the World Championship by 1 point, and in a way whereby everyone saw it wasn't your fault. That's the only great thing about it.
Did you say anything, or curious what Frank Williams and Patrick Head had to say when you made it back to the garage?
No, I don't think I spoke to anybody.
Were you upset with them?
No, I was just, I wasn't upset with anyone in particular. I was just shell-shocked and numb that, you know, there we were with a 40-second lead over the fourth position. All I had to do was finish third. There was only 18 laps to go, and I was just, taking it easy coming home, but unfortunately it wasn't to be.
1987 British Grand Prix. Okay, you were interviewed by Dave Despain on Speed TV, and you said this, that you made that great pass on Piquet against team orders. First of all, your thoughts on that pass, and how does that move stand in terms of your achievements?
It's one of the best moves because, I mean, we had to pick up a deficit of 24 seconds over about 20 laps, and we only had probably one chance to do the manoeuvre because Nelson is very, very revered. He's a great world champion, and, you know, he's not easy to pass. But I set him up going down Hanger Straight. I did a dummy to the left and then jink to the right and managed to get alongside, and we touched going into Stowe pretty much flat out. And but, you know, I won the race with no fuel, and the engine blew up on the slowdown lap. So it was a most perfect ending to a British weekend with winning the race.
If I may ask, you know, your rivalry with Nelson Piquet was, you know, very intense on the track, just like with Senna, but he was even totally out of control in terms of verbal abuse, if I may say. What triggered that?
Well, I don't think it's anything personal. It's he uses anything in the book and his arsenal to upset people. He's done it with Prost, he's done it with Ayrton, certainly done it with me. And, you know, there's no holds barred. He says the most outrageous things about your family, your wife, your children, you, anybody else, if he thinks it will destabilize you in any way. But it didn't bother me because I just feel people who do that show themselves up.
Did Frank Williams or Patrick Head ever try to talk to him to cool down?
I don't think anybody could reason, you know, with people like that. When they say and do things like that, it's just a great shame. I think it's just a bit of a character flaw. I think it's a misjudgment on their part, because for me, Nelson's better than that. He doesn't have to do that.
Exactly.
You know, he's a great world champion, and he doesn't have to do things like that.
1989 Rio, first race with Ferrari. You win first time out, and you are then Il Leone with the Tifosis. What was the atmosphere working in an Italian team compared to an English team?
Magical. The Italian and Ferrari were just starting to climb up the ladder again, and it was wonderful to be part of their organization, and to win three races for them with the time I had with them there was fantastic. I enjoyed every minute. It was a great challenge. It was very a political team when I was there. And then shortly after I left and Prost left, you know, the complete rejuvenation of Ferrari came with Michael Schumacher and certain personnel. And I think it's wonderful the success Ferrari have had, and so richly and well deserved. And for me, I still think, you know, Williams, Ferrari, you know, Ferrari for me has still got the edge to be the best team.
Now, I read somewhere that you were the last driver personally selected by Enzo Ferrari. Sure. Did you meet him? Did you get to know him?
I had dinners with him and was signed by him. I was the last driver to be signed. And again, I felt very privileged because, you know, meeting the great man and seeing how he operates. And it was a respect that he had for everybody, but more so everybody had for him. You know, if he just started to move, everyone would be quiet instantly in case he wanted to say something. And it was a magical time at Ferrari.
Now, let me tell you, I've been following motor racing since 1973. The greatest motor racing pass, strictly in my opinion, that I would love to watch on YouTube, 1990 Mexico. Tell me about that, please.
Yeah, with Gerhard Berger. It was one of those maneuvers. A number of laps before, Gerhard locked up coming in down the straight and almost punted me off. I had to go left. The corner went right, so he didn't hit me. And he overtook me, what I feel, in a bad way, not in a good way. So I thought, well, I'm not going to let you get away with that. And, of course, I sort of picked the car up and drove it harder and harder. And I thought, well, going into the Peralta, I'm just not going to lift. I'm going to overtake you on the outside. And I overtook him on the outside. And it was literally one of those maneuvers which is very dangerous. It's a shit or bust maneuver because if it comes off, you're a hero. And if it doesn't, you could kill yourself. And I've done a couple of those over the years, and it was a magical manoeuvre, and I know it impressed a number of people, because although I came second in the race, I was clapped by the whole teams in the pit lane when I came in, because they really thought it was the most amazing manoeuvre. So it was neat.
did Berger have to say? I'll tell you, I was watching it with a friend of mine, and there on TV live, it was showing Gerhard Berger in-car camera, and he's approaching, you come on the outside, and you're gone. And we just looked at each other speechless.
He couldn't believe it either. He was in shock that someone could be that stupid to try and do that.
How does that stack up for you against passing Senna and Hungaroring?
Yeah, they're both very technical, very ballsy moves. The Hungarian, I boxed Ayrton in Hungary, and that was a great positioning. It was like a chess game, and that was with Ayrton to outfox him. And to win that race was very special.
1992, your championship year, and again a tremendous battle between you and Senna in the streets of Monte Carlo. Do you think there was a way to pass him if there was another lap or two left?
Probably, if I'd have lost my front nose cone and, we could have had an accident. I mean, we were fighting tooth and nail, and Ayrton was like a bus in front. He was moving left, he was moving right, moving left again. Under the new rules now, he would have been black flagged. So, technically, I can look back and say, I should have been given that race. But it led for a lot of excitement. It was very dangerous. It was very frustrating because I had to concentrate on not having an accident at every corner because it was blocking all the time. But it was great motorsport. It was great motor racing. It was very exciting, and but also just a little bit disappointing because I'd like to have won Monaco.
Question: Canada, when you were waving to the people on the last lap, and cars stopped. What really happened there? I've heard that the system shut it down, or you killed the switch. What's the truth?
The actual truth is that the old semi-automatic gearbox failed and put the car into neutral, and I just couldn't get a gear, and it was a great disappointment and great shame, and what can you say? And then you have certain minorities of the press make up these stories that you knock the ignition switch off, and really it's so pathetic, it's unbelievable, other than the fact some people actually believe it. So it was devastating because it was the most perfect race. We had a huge lead, and I was actually taking it easy on the slowdown lap, and then fate strikes, just like the tire exploding, which was a great visible thing in 86, which people will see, God, the tire exploded. With an electrical failure, you can't see anything. The engine just stops. So that's what happened.
Okay. Now, when you won the championship, you came to the U.S. Was money the only main reason that you left Williams in Formula One to come here?
No, I mean, the thing is when you win the world championship, you really expect to be given the opportunity to defend it in the manner that you won it. And, there's no secret that Prost wanted me out of the team. And, they offered me half the salary to stay there for the following year. And so that's as good as saying, well, we don't want you there. When you're world champion, you've got to make the opportunities. I was offered a good deal to come to America, a new adventure, a new beginning. We lived in America at the time as well. And so, destiny would have it that when one door closed, another one opened, and then it was like a fairy tale. We won the championship back to back. I'm the only person in the history of auto racing that held two championships simultaneously across the Atlantic. Only four people have achieved it, which is in no particular order, Emerson Fittipaldi, Mario Andretti, myself, and Jacques Villeneuve. So, it's a special bit of history.
Talking of Alain Prost, I was reading an interview in Motorsports with Damon Hill, and he said that he did not learn a thing from Alain Prost, but he learned from Senna, with whom he only had three races. How was your experience with Prost as a teammate at Ferrari?
Alain is a very clever man, is very political. He works very much with the sponsors and the officials, and whatever he can do to get the advantage out of the car, he's very good at that. He's a very good driver, but he's a driver, he's not a racer. And so he used every means he can, and obviously, I was privileged or lucky or unlucky to drive with three world champions, with Keke Rosberg, Alain Prost, and obviously Nelson Piquet. For me, the best world champion I drove from was Keke Rosberg. I learned more from Keke Rosberg because He was a complete racer, Keke, and he was a thoroughbred man. He was a great human being. He drove the car 10 tenths, and he was, for me, a real honest race car driver.
You won your first ever IndyCar race, and was that a surprise to you? And how did you find the competition, depth of competition in IndyCar racing in 1993 as opposed to Formula One?
In some ways, it was a lot harder in IndyCar because at that time there was always 6 to 8 drivers that could win the races. There was a lot more leveler playing field. The tracks were tougher. It was a challenge learning the new ways. It was a challenge with driving for 30-odd years clockwise circuits to then come over and drive anti-clockwise circuits. The ovals were an enormous challenge, and obviously I found out at my first attempt how dangerous they were. 148 stitches in my back with a crash at Phoenix. But I enjoyed it, and you know, it's something to look back and reflect on, and feel very proud that I conquered America at the first attempt. And I still believe to qualify in pole position and win the first race has never been done since.
What is the key to going fast on an oval compared to road courses?
Close your eyes and hope. you need a very good team to set the car up. You need a good team to set the car up to put you in the window that you're in the ballpark, and then you need to be very patient in what I call perfecting the car, tickling the car, tweaking the car, and getting the balance as close as you possibly can to neutral to understeer. Any oversteer on an oval, it can bite you really hard. And you have to be patient, you have to get the staggers and the tires right, you have to get the cross weight right. There are so many things that you have to do, and you really need a fantastic team that understands oval racing to help you do that.
Mario Andretti was your teammate at Newman Haas, and he was recently quoted as saying that if Ronnie Peterson was his best teammate, he would put you on the other end of the scale. How would you respond to that?
Everyone has their opinion. I think my response to that is Mario, I think, is a very good person. He's a great world champion. He's done fantastic things for motorsport. I'm a father. I have 2 sons. I think the timing of me coming to Newman Haas was the timing when Michael went to McLaren in Formula One. And as we all know, Michael had a terrible time and experience in Formula One. Mario, obviously, is his father. I was having a great time in IndyCar, and I know it didn't go down well with Mario. I came over and won races, won the championship, and I know it was a tough time for him, but I think it's a shame that he took it out on me rather than actually understanding why he wasn't very happy with things.
Looking back at your career, your most memorable race moments, what do you really cherish from your racing career, not just Grand Prix?
I think the biggest thing I cherish is the fact that I came from nothing and I made a young boy's dream come true, which was mine, to stand momentarily on the top of the world on both sides of the Atlantic, win a lot of races, and still be here to talk to you today. Because in the 70s and 80s, a lot of our drivers were being killed all the time. Formula One in the late 70s, mid-70s, and obviously early 80s, a lot of people died. And I remember in 1980, 81, and 82 was horrendous years. And so to be here today, I look back with great thanks that we achieved some special things and some special memories. And as Gerhard Berger says, at the end of the day, when we're all gone, it's only the history books that's going to tell the story, and perhaps I've written a little bit of history where perhaps we'll be remembered.
You know, you made a comment, came from nothing. Where did you get so much determination that you had? I mean, I cannot even think of a guy succeeding in anything with all the obstacles you had to face. And I'm not saying this just because I'm sitting here. I'm going to say this to all my friends.
I couldn't afford to fail, and I am stubborn, but I had this inner self-belief that all I wanted was equal equipment. If I was given equal equipment and I couldn't win, then I'd walk away tomorrow. I knew if I was given equal equipment, I could win. Being teammates with three different world champions and, you know, three and four world championships, you know, three times Nelson, four times Alan, and obviously Keke. I knew what you needed to actually achieve to win. And you have to be incredibly selfish. You have to have the team working for you, because in the 70s and 80s, the reliability of a Formula One car was not there. If you were outright number one driver, you probably, stats-wise, would finish 30% more races. If you finish 30% more races, you got a chance of winning the World Championship. If you're a number two driver, before you start the season, you might be able to win a race, but you're never going to win a World Championship. And so, you know, I learned an awful lot, and that's why I retired in 1990, because I was not being afforded the opportunity to go for world titles.
Your thoughts on what happened at McLaren between Alonso and Hamilton? And talking of Hamilton, do you think he's a real deal?
We'll see this year. I think it's too early to tell. I mean, you know, you have to be in Formula One a number of years before you see what kind of situation you have. I think Kovalainen will keep Lewis very honest this year. Kovalainen's a very quick driver. I predict there's going to be problems with McLaren again this year. I think it's going to be very interesting. And my my favourites is, I still think Ferrari are going to be good. I think Williams are coming on strong. I think Nico Rosberg's doing a fabulous job. It's good to see Red Bull. It's great to see BMW doing better. And I just hope there's a lot of cars within a second or so this year, so the competition is closer.
You know, when the first hint of trouble came between the two drivers, Alonso and Hamilton, and he was accusing of favoritism because Hamilton is British and so is the team, if you were Alonso's manager, what would you guide or advise him at that stage?
You sometimes just have to keep your head down and do the job, but you know, Alonso is a great world champion. Is a very quick, very talented driver, and you know, only he knows what contract he had with McLaren. But you know, I honestly feel that the whole situation was handled badly, and I think if McLaren look back at, you know, last year, they'll probably behind closed doors, that is, admit that they did a whole number of things wrong, and I think the whole PR exercise between their two drivers at times was pretty appalling.
What about the $100 million fine? You think that's excessive?
I think they're very lucky to still be racing. You know, no one gets fined like that if there isn't absolute proof. And I think if it wasn't for Bernie Eccleston, they were going to be banned for this year as well. I mean, you know, to get caught with so many documents from, you know, Ferrari, I mean, what can you say?
Oh, you know, but Bernie Ecclestone, the Formula One has really become so big as it is right now. How do you look at circuits moving away from Europe, going to places like India soon, South Korea, Bahrain, places where they do not have a rich heritage of motor racing?
I don't think that matters as long as you still have a good balance of heritage of races. To take the Formula One on a world basis is just fantastic, and everybody in Formula One, and especially Mr. Eccleston, should be, you know, complimented, because he's made Formula One what it is today, and is truly a global, incredible machine.
You've lived here and raced in the United States with a lot of success. What will it take for Formula One to have a real strong foothold in the U.S.?
I think Formula One needs to get a little bit leveler playing field, and they need to repair some of the bridges they've burnt. And obviously the terrible race they had here a number of years ago, I think in another couple of years, if they come over here and put on some sensational races and look after the sporting fans, the fans here in America will embrace it like all the other fans worldwide.
Your favorite track on Grand Prix circuit?
I mean, I have several. All the ones I win at are my favorite. But, I mean, obviously, my home track, the British Grand Prix. Winning three on a row in 85, 86, 87, doing the triple was very special. Two at Brands Hatch and then the one at Silverstone. But the most special circuit in the world for me was the old Österreichring. when we used to climb up. It was over 4 miles long, and the Bosch curve, and some unbelievable corners which were very ballsy.
What about everybody's favorite, Spa-Francorchamps?
Well, Spa is probably very close, yeah, absolutely, to the old Osterreich ring. But for me, the Osterreich ring just had it, but Spa's very close second, yeah.
How soon or how long before we see the Mansell name back in Formula One or Indy cars?
No idea. We're on this journey. As Paul Newman said to me years ago, come and have an adventure. Well, in 2008, we're having an adventure with the Walker Racing team, and we'll see where it takes us.
Okay, finally, how about a message for our listeners? And we have quite a few listeners in the UK, so if you have any message for countrymen.
Yeah, I mean, please come and say hello and support us. We're here at Laguna Seca in May. We're looking forward to having a fun, challenging time. And I'd just like to congratulate all the racing fans for all the support they give racing in America, because I think motor racing fans are very knowledgeable, and they know how to behave, and it's just a joy to come and race in America.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And, of course, a big thank you to Nige and Machismo, as far as I'm concerned. Speaking with Nasser, outstanding job, Nasser. Keep up the good work. So, Steve, let's go right into some emails. And I think Nasser's got some emails as well. Steve first, Nasser second.
Okay. First one's from Roger in Seattle, formerly from Juneau. And he talks about car control. Wasn't it fun to see the drivers driving? Enjoyed seeing the tails kick out. The drivers were back to driving again, and it was so fun to watch. I'm really looking forward to 2008 and your commentary on the season ahead. Roger Redifer of Seattle. Thanks, Roger. We appreciate it. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. That was a very entertaining race. The next one is from Pete, and Pete writes, podcast format. Have you guys considered shortening, focusing your podcast? I enjoyed Nasser's comments, and especially his historical pieces and interviews. But the length of the podcast, especially over a race weekend, is daunting. I don't get a chance to listen to all of your stuff until some of it is old news. I assume you have seen, heard your competition side podcast has done a very good job of focusing their content, for example. If I push the center button on the iPod, I get an indicator breaking up the different segments. I understand you have different goals, Mondial, and discussion of teams, races, etc. While I'm being critical, I'd like to mention that Desiree's reading style is like she's reading. Also, try to keep Steve closer to the microphone. Sometimes he's inaudible. Finally, Clark has a habit of saying, keep up the good work, is transparently indicative of the fact that he has nothing of value to say at the moment. It would be useful exercise to ban that phrase. On the positive side, I really appreciate your efforts, and your website is done well and, at the moment, far more useful than your podcast. One listener's opinion, that's all. Thanks for your efforts. I hope this can be considered useful, Pete.
Well, you should have Clark read this email, and then you could have said to him, keep up the good work.
That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, exactly.
True. Balancing act, you know.
These are good emails. They want us to improve, and we always listen to these emails and actually slowly improve the show. So
exactly.
You know.
A number of the things that he's brought up, one, we've talked about format changes. We're pretty set at the way it is now. We've talked about spinning Mondial off onto its own. We haven't done that. As far as chapterizing the podcast, we haven't done that because if we do that, then we become iTunes dependent, and we don't want to do that. Outside of the rest of it, we are constantly trying to improve, and we hope that we have in the 260 times that we've managed to do this.
And the important thing is, you know, when people write and complain or show dislike, they're doing this because they care.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We always look forward to that. We appreciate
the feedback.
That.
I can feel the love in this room right now.
Okay, stay away from me.
Exactly.
Nass, you got an email?
A couple of them. I would like to thank Mike Dodson for sending me a story that was in the Wall Street Journal of March 14. Title is, Will Toyota's Way Win on the Track? And according to the story, have you seen this story, by the way?
No, I don't get the Wall Street Journal. I'm sorry, Nasser.
Check your email.
Oh, okay.
Okay, according to the story, since coming to the F1 party in 2002, they have spent an estimated $2.5 billion and are still looking for first win, and even more amazingly, to continue with their consensus style. And general consensus in the racing world, which I agree, is that Toyota will stay behind the so-called best of the rest group this year, which would be BMW and Williams. What say you?
I agree, but I think they have made some progress. And as we saw their first NASCAR win, I believe, was
a good comparison. Week? Thank you so much.
Am I good? See, I know what's going on.
Rowdy Bush and Timo Glock,
Yeah. Thank you very much. But I think the win is out there for them. Just like Michelangelo always said, you know, the carving is there. They just need to get rid of the junk that's on the outside. So they're getting it, but I think they still have a couple more
years. There's a victory inside that big block of marble.
Exactly.
What say you, Mr. Favre?
I've seen improvement last season. They were one of the more consistent teams as far as getting into the third qualifying session. But they had a nasty habit of just falling back the entire race, which was kind of odd. See how it goes. Again, their management style hasn't worked well in Formula One. As Clark mentions, it apparently works really well in tin tops. But only time will tell. I have a feeling that they're probably 5 years. If they haven't won a victory in Formula One in 5 years, they'll probably bail.
If they see Honda make big strides,
which is what's going to happen this
year. Is what's going to happen, it's going to be obvious that, we should have gotten Ross Brawn, and they're going to look for somebody of that caliber.
I have a feeling down the road they'll end up owning Williams Grand Prix Engineering.
I hope not, but very possible. But they need that.
Yeah. Okay, also I would like to thank Roland Cuellar for a story also from Wall Street Journal, and this appeared on March, in the issue of March 18th, on possible sale of Ford's Jaguar and Land Rover division to India's Tata Group, and this has been going on for a while. And there is a director by the name of Ravi for Tata Motors, and he is reported in this story that he has assured employees that there would be no attempt to Indianize the companies. So production from Coventry will not be shifting to Calcutta or something like that. And after the sale, Ford would continue to supply UK-built engines to Jaguar and Land Rover for a 5 to 7 year period. And you may know this, that the CEO of Ford is now Alan Mulally. He used to be at Boeing, so he knows a thing or two about hard landings and turbulence, both a common feature at the Blue Oval these days. And I have a bag of historical goodies, if I may proceed with your express written consent.
Yes, you may proceed, because goodies are always good for the program.
Yeah, this is beautiful information, and
I
love to
share this. Quite stimulating.
Yeah, it is, and I love to share this kind of information. Okay, Moss before Stirling. Alfred Moss, father of racing legend Stirling Moss, raced in the 1924 Indy 500 and finished 16th in his Fronte Ford. I just got to know this about a week or two ago, and I just could not believe. Unbelievable, amazing.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Timing is everything. This is very interesting. The 1933 Monaco Grand Prix was the first event to use qualifying times to determine the grid. Race was won from pole position by Italian Achille Varzi in a Bugatti. His qualifying time was 2 minutes, 2 seconds. Clark, when I read this thing, even though I knew this as a historical fact, but when I read this today, I had massive chills when freeze frame for 5 minutes. Fellow Italian Borzacchini was second in an Alfa Romeo. Now keep in mind, we're going back 1933. He was second in an Alfa Romeo entered by, are you ready for this, Scuderia Ferrari.
Machismo.
And you know, every time I see a picture of Enzo Ferrari in Alfa Romeo, either as a driver or standing, massive chills. What do you call them?
Frisson.
Yeah. Ferrari Frisson.
There you go, the two Fs.
Yes, sir. Now we come to the winning formula. Formula One is unveiled by FIA in 1947. Best thing ever done for mankind by mankind. And I say, thank you, Payne Weber. Thank you, FIA. Okay, now we come to Alpha domination. All 6 Grand Prix in the first year of Formula One championship, which would be 1950, are won by Alfa Romeo. They also win the first 3 races in 1951, but the prancing horse with an Argentine rider by the name of Fraulein Gonzalez steals the show at Silverstone, starting a tradition which continues to this day and age. Empire Strikes Back. British drivers, this is very impressive. British drivers win all 10 races in the 1963 Grand Prix season. And I don't think this has ever happened again, that one nationality wins all the races. World champion Jim Clark taking 7 wins, Graham Hill 2 and John Surtees 1. And, you know, impressive is that this is 1963. Surtees wins 1. And the following year, 1964, he becomes the first man, first and only man so far to be world champion.